It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The Tuskegee Airmen are taking center stage this week in western Pennsylvania. 90.5 WESA's Mark Neutbar reports that there are strong ties between the region and the World War II pilots that fought equally hard against Axis forces and racism.
They were officially known as the 332nd Fighter Group and the 477th Bombardment Group, but the world remembers them as the Tuskegee Airmen. And yesterday, a new semi-permanent display honoring this all-African-American corps was unveiled at the Pittsburgh International Airport by County Executive Rich Fitzgerald.
We need to recognize these heroes. That's truly what they are heroes. And it's really long past due that this community does recognize the work that they've done, the heroic work that they did to provide freedom for all of us.
The display covers three walls of an alcove on Concourse A of the Airside Terminal. Tuskegee Airmen Memorial Project Coordinator Rich Dieter says the first two panels feature pictures and information about the group's efforts during the war, and the third looks at their lives after returning home.
There's one plaque that specifically talks about the double V, victory at home against racism and victory abroad against the Nazis. And that was a campaign that was started by the Pittsburgh Courier back during World War II.
While the Pittsburgh Courier was known as the nation's black newspaper of record, it had a good reason as a Pittsburgh-based newspaper to focus on the Tuskegee Airmen. There is no one single list of all the men and women who served in the Corps, but it is widely believed that there were about 1,400 pilots and support crew. Through recent research, it has been learned that about 100 of them were from western Pennsylvania.
Nobody has really determined why that happened. I don't know what the appeal was, but for some reason, African-American men and women from western Pennsylvania felt that it was their duty to serve their country.
The unveiling of the display at the airport was just the first event in a four-day celebration of the Tuskegee Airmen. It will continue tonight with a concert by Josh White Jr. at the Edgeworth Club, and then the New York cast of the long-running Broadway play Black Angels Over Tuskegee will perform tomorrow at the Byam Theater. Writer and director Leon Gray says the story follows the lives of six airmen and their families, from their decision to sign up, through their time overseas, and then into their lives back stateside.
They had to stick together in order for this experiment to succeed, because it wasn't supposed to succeed. Everyone thought it would fail. No one thought that it would go on and do the incredible things that it did.
Gray says he was compelled to write the play after learning about the men and women because he says their story is not told in history books.
I always tell people this isn't just African-American history. It's American history.
The play has been running for 4 years to audiences of all ages and races, but Gray says he is most excited when he takes the show to schools or when former Tuskegee Airmen come to the theater. The 4 days of events will culminate with the ribbon cutting of a Tuskegee Airmen memorial at the Sewickley Cemetery. The memorial will include two granite slabs celebrating the members of the fighter and bomber groups, and then two slabs listing the names of the nearly 100 members that have been identified as hailing from the region. Dieter says alongside each name, there will be a QR code that can be read by a smartphone to link to more information.
The QR codes will include some history. As much as we can gather from family members, we'll put on pictures, biographies of the airmen.
The goal is to have those codes populated by Veterans Day. Dieter says if more servicemen and women are found, their names will be added to the memorial.
We're certain there are several airmen from western Pennsylvania that we've yet to identify.
Dieter says there are some amazing stories to tell about the men and women who were members of the Corps.
We all know how successful they were in helping the United States and its allies defeat the Nazis. But after the war, several of these men and women went on to very illustrious careers.
Four former Tuskegee Airmen living in the Pittsburgh area are expected to take part in the ribbon cutting Sunday, including lawyer Wendell Freeland and medical doctors Harry Linaze and Robert Higginbotham. Dieter says many of the men and women also went on to play key roles in the civil rights movement.
I keep saying one woman. There was one woman from Beaver County. Her name is Rose May Willis Alford. Later went on to become the guidance counselor at Brighton School District, where she retired from. She's now passed away.
None of the Tuskegee Airmen are buried in the Sewickley Cemetery, but Dieter says space behind the memorial will be set aside for any veterans who choose to be buried there in the future. For 90.5 WESA News, I'm Mark Neutbar.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Last year, when the movie Red Tails, which tells the story of the Tuskegee Airmen, was released, I had a conversation with former Tuskegee Airmen and Pittsburgh native Lieutenant Colonel Edward Harris. He was a pilot in the 477th Bomber Group, who served during World War II and saw combat in Korea, flying over 150 combat missions. He was raised in Pittsburgh's Hill District and was a straight-A student who graduated from Schenley High School. I asked Mr. Harris how he became a Tuskegee Airman.
In 1943, the recruiters from the Army Air Corps came around to Schenley High School, where I was then in my senior year, and offered us a chance to get into the branch of service of our own desires, and they recommended the Air Force if we could qualify. And so there was a qualification test given. I took the test and became qualified to become an aviation cadet.
When you began flying, the armed forces were segregated. How difficult was it for you during training and when you first began to serve?
Well, not being a military person and being faced with regimentation of a very strict order was very difficult, especially some of the student instructors didn't take kindly to our cadets. And although I had little trouble, I did have some trouble, as all of our pilots did.
If it hadn't been for the Tuskegee program, would you have been able to realize your dream of flying?
No, because my family wasn't able to pay for that kind of training. You'd have to become an engineer or at least have two or more years of college. And I was not able to pay for that kind of training.
By the summer of 1945, the 477th Bomber Group was combat ready. You were set to fly in the Pacific Theater in August of 1945, just as the bomb dropped in Japan. How disappointed were you, if at all, that you didn't see combat?
Very disappointed. In fact, the whole group was almost completely demoralized. We had our moralization very high, looking forward to going overseas, and realized our ambition of helping the country overcome Japan. And when that bomb dropped, that killed our chances, and so we were all very disappointed.
My guest is Lieutenant Colonel Edward Harris. The Army Air Corps was segregated during World War II, but by 1947, you were recalled to an integrated National Guard to fight in Korea. What was it like to go from a segregated situation during World War II to an integrated Air National Guard in 1947?
Very difficult in the Guard itself. Once we got out of the National Guard and into the main Air Force Corps, it was very realistic and very thrilling. We were treated with kindness and treated with no different than any other white pilot.
You would go on to see action in Korea, flying over 150 combat missions. How much did it mean to you to finally see action?
It meant a lot to me because the 477th, all the pilots were grouped and ready to go and into service and fight for the country. And having failed there, it was very rewarding to come back and fly B-26s into combat.
We're talking with Pittsburgh native Lieutenant Colonel Edward Harris, who was a pilot in the 477th Bomber Group who served during World War II and saw combat in Korea, flying over 150 combat missions, one of the Tuskegee Airmen and a Pittsburgh native. And when you think, Lieutenant Colonel Harris, about the recognition that the Tuskegee Airmen are getting today in particular, how gratifying is that for you?
It's very gratifying because for a long time we had to do our own gratification by traveling to various sites that wanted to see us and wanted to hear about us. And so it was very nice to have a big production like the Red Tails on movies.
And you've seen the movie?
Yes, I saw the movies.
What'd you think
of
it?
Very realistic. You have to remember, this was just simply a cutout of some of the activities that the fighter pilots had to go through. It was not the entire range of obstacles and missions and situations that they face. Only a small cutout of those particular actions.
We've been talking with A Pittsburgh native, Lieutenant Colonel Edward Harris, one of the Tuskegee Airmen who's been with us by phone from Ewing, New Jersey. And Lieutenant Colonel Harris, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we'll meet Wendell Freeland, who shares his experiences as a Tuskegee Airman in a segregated U.S. military. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're devoting much of today's show to honoring the legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen, including Wendell Freeland, an attorney from Shadyside who was a bombardier on B-25s in the all-black 477th Bombardier Group. He also was arrested twice during his 2 years of service for defying the segregation rules the U.S. Armed Forces still had in place during World War II. I began the interview by asking him what forms of racism he faced early on.
Well, we were always segregated, no matter where we went. As a bombardier, we went to Tyndallfield, Florida, to gunnery school. All bombardiers and navigators were also gunners. Then we went back to Tuskegee. Well, at Tyndallfield, Florida, we were in gunnery school and went to the movies. Well, at Tuskegee, where we had been, they were all blacks. But when we got to Tyndallfield, we went to the movie, and they wanted to put our group upstairs in the base movie house. Well, since we had not had that experience at Tuskegee, I objected to that, as our group did. The movie was then shown to us in a hangar, and all gunnery students, white and black, would have to go to different hangars, of course, and watch the movie a couple of reels after everybody else saw it on the base movie. That was my first experience in fighting discrimination. The IG came in, the Inspector General, and I was interviewed because our commandant knew I had gone to Howard. And for some reason, he thought it was Howard College in Alabama. And therefore, he thought that I should be a good person to talk to the IG. He was a little bit confused. It was Howard University in Washington.
Washington, right.
And Howard College in Alabama was a white school. And of course, because of my complexion, he may have thought I was confused about where I went to school. Actually, it was in 45 when I first became attached to the 477th. We were at Godman Field, Kentucky. Godman Field, Kentucky is right across the street or the highway from Fort Knox, where all of your gold is. The command of the 477th was all white. Selway was the colonel, a bigot by birth, I suppose, certainly by habit. And he made arrangements with the Fort Knox leadership to let all of the white officers, who were all of the senior officers in the 477th, stay at Fort Knox. So they stayed at the BOQs, that's Bachelor Officers Quarters at Fort Knox, and went to the officers' club there and to the swimming pools and tennis courts and the like. We, the black members of 477th, bombardiers, navigators, pilots, and the rest, had an officers' club, which was just a large room with a pool table, a poker table, and a bar. We didn't know anything about country clubs, and that's where we were. Well, the 477th was then transferred to Freeman Field, Indiana. I was in Squadron E, replacement squadron. We remained at Godman Field, but we heard that when the 477th went to Freeman Field, Indiana, it was told that there were two clubs, a white officers' club and a colored officers' club. Well, many of us who were there at Godman knew of this, and we all decided that when we went to Freeman Field, Indiana, we would test the validity of the separation of race there.
And this was a loophole that Colonel Robert Selway, he was someone who tried and did to a large extent enforce strict segregation policies that really affected morale for the members of the 477th who were transferred to his base in Indiana. And he was using a loophole for preventing black and white officers from using the same facilities, designating one officers' club at Freeman.
Well, he created a loophole, and let me speak to that.
Sure.
When we were at Godman, we knew that the Army regulations prior to World War II provided that there should be no separation, discrimination by reason of race, creed, or color among officer personnel. Of course, that was not very important in the military prior to World War II, but by World War II, there were a number of Negro officers. Therefore, it could become a problem, and it probably was a problem in many other services. You must remember that the officers who were Tuskegee Airmen at Godman Field and wherever they were considered themselves to be the best and the brightest. Most of us were college students. Some, like Colonel Harris, were recruited directly from high school. There were several of us, to my knowledge, who had master's degrees. We relied upon the Army regulation, which provided for no discrimination by reason of race, creed, or color, and decided that when we got to Freeman Field, Indiana, we would test it. So on our first night there, 69 of us went to the, quote, White Officers Club, end quote, individually, not en masse, but individually. In my own situation, I went to the club, and I was greeted by an officer, a white officer, of course, who told me not to enter. I thanked him and went in and read a magazine. After I sat there for a few minutes, I did not go into the bar, if there was a bar, and I just stayed in the foyer. I then left, and I was greeted by the same colonel who said, consider yourself under arrest to quarters. Well, as an officer, I was not sent off to the guardhouse. I was restricted to my BOQ, or Bachelor Officers Quarters, area. So I went back there, and there were 69 of us, as I said, on that first night.
But you were arrested twice, and I think you just described the first incident. Now, what happened the second time you were arrested? What were you asked to do?
The command decided that it would call all of us together, those 69 of us plus all of the other officers, and present us with base regulations. And you were referring to Selway's loophole. This was the loophole he created.
Right.
That the facilities at Freeman Field, Indiana, would be divided among trainee personnel, officer trainee personnel, and officer instructor personnel. By the strangest of coincidences, all trainees were black and all instructors were white. And so there was a separation not only of officers' clubs, but of BOQs, swimming pools, tennis courts.
This was something that Selway had worked out.
This is what he had worked out. So we were presented with this piece of paper and asked to sign that we had read and understood it. Many people complained that they read it but did not understand it. Some said, well, can I sign it and say I don't agree with it? And the command was perfectly willing to have that done if one would sign it. But there was a group of us who would not sign at that time. And each of us individually was then told on several days later to go to the headquarters. And I can tell you again about my own situation. Though this experience has been called the Freeman Field Mutiny, and it was in fact a mutiny, had it been a mutiny at the time, we would probably all have been shot.
But you were refusing to obey a direct order of a superior officer in wartime, an offense for which the maximum punishment was death. How concerned were you about being put up in front of a firing squad?
Well, I don't know whether I visualized this firing squad, but when my commanding officer, Anthony Anciappi, said, I, Anthony Anciappi, Captain of the Army Air Corps, order you to sign this piece of paper, and I remained mute and was told that my refusal to sign was disobeying a direct order, I was a little bit upset, nervous as hell, because I was 20 years old. But I was committed. In fact, 101 of us were committed. And we left command headquarters, and we tipped our hats so that the next guy going in would know that he was not alone. If you didn't sign, you tipped your hat. As I said, 101 did not sign. We were then placed under arrest to quarters again at Freeman Field, Indiana. Several days later, we were called to pack enough clothes for 2 weeks. were told to go out to near the tarp, and Colonel Selway was there. He told us we had failed our command and our country, and then we were escorted to C-47s, big transport planes. We were then transported back to Godman Field, Kentucky. There we were greeted with by white MPs, complete with 45 submachine guns held across their bodies, and we were piled into buses. These were prisoner buses. So there we were at Godman Field, back at our old bachelor officers' quarters.
Did any white officers support you?
I never spoke to a white officer. But you must remember, most of the senior officers in the military in World War II were from the South, and they brought with them their prejudices and their patterns of discrimination.
We're talking with Wendell Freeland. He is an attorney from Shadyside who was one of the Tuskegee Airmen. Mr. Freeland was a bombardier on B-25s in the all-black 477th Bombardier Group. He was arrested twice during his years of service for defying the segregation rules the U.S. Armed Forces still had in place during World War II. And his unit, the 477th Bomber Group, was instrumental in creating desegregation policies, lighting the fire, as it were, under President Truman to desegregate the U.S. armed forces. I'm curious if you ever asked yourself while all this was going on, why am I fighting for a country and putting potentially my life on the line for a country where I'm treated like a second-class citizen?
Well, my view is not defending the country as much as it was defeating Hitler and Mussolini. I was thinking about my country as a country that was fighting against Nazism and fascism and all of the ills that had been visited upon the world by these forces.
Our first guest, Lieutenant Colonel Edward Harris, was called back and served in the National Guard and fought in Korea. Your service ended after those 2 years during World War
II. It ended absolutely, because by the time the war ended, I was back at Tuskegee, and no longer with the 477th, I was on detached duty at Tuskegee. But I would get in my mailbox a letter, do you want to stay in the Air Force for 6 months? Do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? And my answer was always no. I was a civilian who was in the military. Unlike Colonel Harris, I had no interest in flying. I didn't know a Piper Cub from a B-17.
So then, to what extent did your experiences in a segregated military influence your decision to become a lawyer?
I always wanted to become a lawyer. But my activity there was a bridge from my childhood to my adulthood. It reinforced my basic instincts to fight for black liberty and equality.
Wendell Freeland has been our guest. He was a member of the all-black 477th Bomber Group during World War II, and it's been a pleasure getting a chance to meet you and to talk with you here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Well, I've enjoyed being with you. Take good care.
The play, Black Angels Over Tuskegee, will take place at the Byam on Saturday at 8 p.m. Also, those planning to attend the memorial dedication on Sunday at Swickley Cemetery can park at Quaker Valley school lots with free shuttles to the cemetery. Up next, fall's coming. We'll learn about ways to preserve the harvest. And night football returns to its Pennsylvania birthplace after an absence of 121 years. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.